into firing position. So, this timeline is built around CCTV, which says you got on the bus at 10 to 7, Rory, and you got off it in Stony Banter at 7:15. That doesn't exactly match what you told us. But hey, like we said, a few minutes here, a few minutes there to normal people. He smiles at Rory, who's still relaxed enough to smile back. Except after that, the next time we can confirm your location is when you are caught on Tesco CCTV, paying for the flowers, at 7:51. Rory's smile is gone. He's starting to cop on. Breslin's voice is getting more weight to it, words coming down on the table with thick, cold thuds. Like we said, from Aisling's place to Tesco is about a 7-minute walk. So if you were paying for the flowers at 7:51, you had to leave Viking Gardens by around 7:40. That leaves your movements unaccounted for from 7:15 when you got off the bus until 7:40. 25 minutes, Rory. We've just established that even a normal person couldn't lose track of 25 minutes. Do you want to tell me what you were doing for those 25 minutes? Rory is staring at the space between me and Breslin. He's clenched into one tight knot. His mouth barely moves when he says, "I've already told you." "I thought you had," I say, miffed. The thought of losing his lovely ally makes his breathing speed up, but he doesn't look at me. "But now it looks like you've been feeding us a great big heap of shite. You want to try again, before we decide we might have a reason for not wanting us to know what you were doing that night?" "I've told you what I did. I can't help it if it doesn't match your timeline." "It's not a bad strategy. Pick a story, plant your feet in it, and don't budge, no matter what. Once you start shifting, we can shove you off balance, push you step by step to where we want you. We need Rory shifting." Breslin swings his chair to the table and sits down in one fast sweep. I sit back, let him work it for now, while Rory wonders if I'm still his pal. He says, "How'd you know Aisling didn't have curtains in her kitchen?" That gets through. Rory jerks and stares. "What?" "And the laneway at the back. How'd you know about that?" "What lane?" "You described your theoretical stalker watching Aisling cook the dinner and get out wine glasses. Stuff she would have done in the kitchen, which is at the back of the house. You didn't have him watching her set the table, which is in the living room at the front. In other words, you knew the stalker would have been able to watch from the back of the house." Rory blinks wildly, bewildered. Breslin says, grinning, "Dude, see that glass there? I was right behind it, listening, for your whole chat. Antoinette's a top-notch detective, but she's... How'll I put this without getting a punch?" "Careful, you," I say. "Easy, tiger," Breslin says, leaning away and holding up a hand to block me. "Let's just say she's a little more willing than I am to believe that you're on our side. She's an optimist. She's been hoping all along that this case would turn out to be some great big fascinating mystery." A slant of side eye towards me. A hair's breadth of grin that could mean anything. "Me? I've been around longer. I'm a suspicious guy. More of that professional deformation we were talking about. So I keep an eye on things. I heard just about every word you said. And I'm asking you, how did you know the stalker would have been watching Aisling in her kitchen? Unless you were the stalker?"
"I was guessing. It's just basic common sense. If he didn't want the neighbour seen and that he would have..."
Rory's breath isn't working right.
"And the kitchen, that's where she's going to be preparing, isn't it? If I'm coming, which I was, I don't mean if..."
He's losing his foothold on that safe story. I say, a touch of worry, not happy with where things are going. "Here's another thing. You talked about the stalker seeing Aisling singing into her corkscrew."
We know from her texts that that's exactly what she was doing that evening. How did you know about that? Unless you were watching her do it. Breslin says, before Rory can get enough air to answer, do me a favour. Don't try and tell us you were guessing. Unless you're psychic, there's no way in hell you could guess that. Are you psychic, Rory?
What? No. How could I? I don't.
Well, that's a relief. So tell us how you knew about the corkscrew. Rory shakes his head, panting and wordless. I say, then I'll tell you. You watched Aisling from the back laneway that evening. Am I right? After a long moment, his head rocks helplessly on his neck. Yes. That's how you spent the missing 25 minutes. Another nod. That one-way glass splattering light into the corner of my eye again. I hope Steve is behind it. I hope he's scarlet right up to his hair.
Out loud for the tape, Breslin says.
Rory finds a pinch of voice.
I just wanted to. I was just taking a moment to let it sink in that this was really happening. That's all.
And the only way you could do that, Breslin says, was by peeping through Aisling's back window.
He makes it sound filthy. Rory flinches.
I wasn't. I was just standing there, being happy. I don't know how to explain.
I guess I get it, I say doubtfully.
Sort of. It's not like you were watching her shower.
Or were you?
No. Even if I wanted to, which I didn't, I would have laughed.
Breslin lets out an amused snort.
Rory manages to ignore him by focusing on me. Telling the truth, or telling the story, has given him his breath back. Anyway, I couldn't have. The bathroom window was frosted. Aisling was in the kitchen. She had music on. It was too windy for me to hear what, but I could tell it was something upbeat by the way she was dancing around, singing into, yeah, the corkscrew. A glance at me too sad for defiance. She was wearing a pink jumper and jeans, and she was taking things out of the fridge and opening them, putting them into pans and dancing while she did it. After a bit, she went out of the kitchen. I waited. And when she came back in, she was wearing this blue dress. She looked all blue and gold like that. It was like she just appeared in the kitchen. Like one of those visions of saints that people used to have centuries ago. And she was smiling. And I couldn't believe that in just a few minutes, I would be in there with her. She would be smiling at me. The grief goes deep, right to the heart of his voice. That means nothing. And then I thought of the flowers, and I headed for Tesco. And if I hadn't... Rory grabs a fast breath through his nose, like he's been hurt. If I had just remembered that azalea plant, if I had just stayed there watching her, I would have been there when he came, and I would have... His mouth starts to curl up. He presses his knuckles to it. I can feel Breslin clamping down a snide grin at the image of Rory throwing on his cape and tights and beating the shit out of the villain. Rory has presumably run through a couple of hundred variations on that scenario. He says, through his fingers, but I didn't do any of that. I skipped off to Tesco like an idiot. And while I was gone, someone came along and killed Aisling. I may have seen him, but I didn't even take it in because I was utterly oblivious to everything except my own happy bubble. And when she didn't answer her door, I waited and waited because I couldn't find a way to believe that she had changed her mind. When just a few minutes earlier she had been acting like she couldn't wait to see me. I was standing in the cold, trying to understand how that was possible, while she was lying inside, dead or dying. And in the end, instead of having the brains to realise that something had to be wrong and breaking the door in, I went home to feel sorry for myself. That's it.
That's what happened.
Jesus, Rory, I say reproachfully. Why didn't you tell us straight out?
Because I know how it sounds. I know it makes me come across like some. I can't expect you to understand what it was actually like. I'm doing my best.
It'd be a lot easier if you'd told us the truth right away.
I'm telling you now.
Under the table, I touch my foot to Breslin's ankle. He says without missing a beat,
"Well, part of the truth anyway.
That wasn't the only time you watched Aisling, was it?" Rory's eyes flash to him and to me and away to a corner. He picks fast.
"Yes, that was the first time."
"No, it wasn't,"
I say. "That's why you needed your moment out the back. To take in that this was real. Because you'd watched her in that kitchen and daydreamed about going in there so many times before, right?"
"Just like the guy in your scenario," Breslin says.
"Your hypothetical scenario."
"It was hypothetical. You asked me to imagine."
"That moment must have felt amazing, did it?" I ask. "After all those times when you'd had to turn around and go home again in the cold."
Yes. It felt wonderful. But not because I'd been... I wasn't stalking, Aisling. I wasn't.
Rory's starting to gibber again. "Shh," Breslin says.
"What?"
"Shh." Breslin picks up his file. "I want to show you something." He leans back and leafs through the file at his leisure, pausing occasionally to lick his thumb. Rory watches with his hands clenching the edge of the table, like he's ready to leap out of his chair, but he keeps his mouth shut. His control isn't completely gone. "Here." Breslin throws a handful of photos, big 8x10s, across the table. Rory grabs at them and sends them scattering. He catches one, takes one look, and makes a high, startled whimper. Breslin says,
"Pick up the rest of them."
Rory doesn't move. His head is down over the photo, but his eyes aren't focusing.
"Pick them up."
Rory moves automatically, stacking the photos one by one. His fingers are trembling.
"Look at them."
He braces himself before he goes through them, but every image still gets a hard blink out of him. Breslin tells the video camera,
"I've just shown Mr. Fallon images from CCTV footage taken in Stony Batter over the past month."
There's a silence.
"Rory, that's you in those pictures. We can all agree on that, can't we?"
More silence. Then Rory's head moves, just a twitch.
"Yes."
"For the tape?"
"Yes."
Breslin leans forward. Rory flinches and brings down a finger on the top photo, the face staring straight into the Tesco camera.
"This is you on the 14th of this month."
"Yes, I was just buying. I was in there looking for..."
His mind is flailing for a new story.
I say,
"You told us you'd never been to Stony Batter before Saturday night, when you had to look up the nearest Tesco on your phone." His mouth moves as he tries to swallow. Breslin's finger is still mashed down on Rory's photo face.
"So," he says pleasantly, "your pretty little story about the guy who got hooked on spying on Aisling, that was based on real events, as they say on the telly, right?"
Not that part where..."
His breathing is starting to get away from him again.
I never...
If he hyperventilates and faints on us, the paperwork is going to take all night, I say. Calm, but firm. "Rory, the part about the guy wandering around Stony Batter to feel closer to Aisling. You've been doing a bit of that, yeah?"
"Yes,
but hang on. One thing at a time. The part about him watching Aisling from the laneway. You did a bit of that too, yeah?"
"I just..."
Rory's rubbing the back of one hand across his mouth.
hard enough to leave red streaks. No, I... Rory, I say, come on. You really want to tell us you were mooning around Stony Battle for weeks, but you never went near Aisling's actual gaff till the exact night she got killed? Because I don't like the sound of that. No, wait. His hands fly up. He's so easy to shove, step by step, back towards the corner he's never going to get out of. I watched her just maybe, just a few times, only to Breslin. He's pulled the photo over to himself and is examining it. Says, but on Saturday night, Aisling caught you out. That voice, easy, almost a drawl, almost friendly, but it fills up the air, leaves no room for anything else. How did it happen? Did she come out onto the patio for some reason? See you hanging over her wall? Or maybe you said something about the trip to Tesco that made it obvious you knew your way around Stony Batter. Maybe you said the kitchen looked nice with the new picture, or you told her you loved beef Wellington. And just like that, Breslin lifts his hands, lets it fall onto the photo with a flat thwack. Your dirty little secret's out. Rory's face is coated in a thin, sick shine of sweat. I was never, no, I wasn't in her house. Breslin ignores that. You walk into that house thinking you're walking into paradise, and inside 5 minutes it's all turned to shite. Jesus, man. Ouch. I'm scarlet for you just thinking about it. The sadistic curl at the corner of his mouth makes that into a joke. How did Aisling take it? It didn't happen. None of that. I bet you remember the exact look on her face. I bet you can't get it out of your head. Was she disgusted with you? Scared of you? Did she think you were a freak or a psycho or a pathetic loser? What did she say, Rory? Rory tries to keep denying, but Breslin doesn't give him the chance. He's leaning across the table, close enough to make Rory smell his breath, his aftershave, the heat of his skin. What? Did she laugh at you? Tell you to get out? Threaten to call us? What did it? What pushed you over the edge? I didn't do anything. It comes out as a wild yelp. Breslin stares. What the living fuck are you talking about? You stalked her, peeped at her. You call that nothing? No. Did she think it was nothing? She didn't know I... That's a load of bollocks. You keep babbling on about needing a moment. But 25 minutes isn't a moment. 25 minutes is more than enough time to take your moment out back. Show up at Aisling's door. Shove your foot in your mouth. Lose the head. Kill Aisling. Clean up after yourself. Realise you need to account for all this time. And head for Tesco. Which is exactly what you did. Rory's face is a strange mix of horror and something almost like relief. He's run this scene in his head 100 times already. Now that it's taken shape and come to find him, it feels like something he already knows. All the sharp corners already rubbed smooth from so much handling. It's actually easier this time. We're doing all the work for him. All he has to do is come out with his lines. He says, I never hurt her. After Breslin's voice, he sounds weightless, a spindly thing floating on the hot air. But you did go into her house, I say. No, I swear. The technical bureau is processing the clothes you wore that night. What are you going to say when we find her carpet fibres on your trousers? You can't. You won't. I wasn't in there. Breslin says, no one else was. But the guy, the stalker guy, oh please. Did you seriously believe you were the first person to think of looking at Aisling's social life? Every guy who ever smiled at her, Rory, we've been all over him like a rash. Every one of them's been eliminated.
Have you got one reason, just one tiny reason, why I should believe your stalker exists?
A sudden jerk out of Rory, his hands coming up. Wait. Yes. There was a guy. On Saturday in the street, I saw a guy.
Our very own Pez machine. Push open his mouth and out pops a brand new story. I roll my eyes. Breslin laughs, a great full-bodied roar that slams Rory back in his chair.
Right. Only then aliens abducted you and wiped your memory, and it's only just conveniently coming back.
No. A piano fell on your head and you got amnesia.
I didn't. On Sunday, you told us flat out that you didn't remember seeing anyone in Stony Batter except a bunch of teenagers playing football and some girls on a night out.
There was no guy, Rory. Rory tries to talk, but that voice crashes through his like it's a spider web, leaves it in tatters.
There's nothing but you. Every piece we turn over, it's got your face in it. The stalker was you, Rory. We all know it. Every single thing you told us about him, it turns out to have been you all along. The only thing left is the part where he knocks at Aisling's door and it all goes wrong. And guess what? That'll turn out to be you too.
No, it won't. I was never in her house, never.
By this time, he looks about a tenth of Breslin's size, but he's turned into all glare and chin. Not so easy to shove any more. We found Rory's sticking point. I move in my chair.
There's one more thing I think is important, I say to Breslin.
We don't need anything else, Conway. We've got plenty. Breslin reaches across to sweep the photos away from Rory and slaps them into a stack.
Let's just put him under arrest. Go get some dinner and come back to this afterwards.
The word arrest opens Rory's mouth, but only breath comes out. His eyes, white-ringed with terror, go to me. Shit just got real.
Hang on, I say to Breslin. Hear me out.
You're the boss, he says with a sigh. He leaves the photos and tilts his chair back, listening.
Okay, I say.
Aisling had the cooker on, right? Making Rory that lovely fancy dinner.
Yeah, and?
And before Rory left, he turned it off. Rory starts to say, I wasn't, but Breslin lifts a hand to shut him up.
Right, that's important how.
The only reason to turn it off, I say, will be that he didn't want the house going on fire. Now, if Rory knew Aisling was dead, or if he didn't care whether she died or not,
hang on a sec.
Rory's trying to talk again. Then his best bet will be to let the place burn. The house goes up in smoke. So does any evidence that he was there. The fibres, the prints, the DNA, the lot. Anyone who's ever seen a cop show on the telly would know that. Am I right?
I'm listening, says Breslin.
To Rory, who's practically coming out of his seat,
you might want to sit down and pay attention to this, pal. It sounds like it might actually do you some good. And just being straight with you, you can't afford to miss anything that'll do that.
After a second, Rory sits back. His chest is going up and down like he's been running.
Breslin asks, are you going to let Detective Conway finish what she's saying?
Yes, I will.
When Breslin's raised eyebrow prompts him,
sorry for interrupting.
My point is, I say, the only reason Rory wouldn't want the place going on fire will be if he didn't think Aisling was dead. And he didn't want her to die, meaning he never intended to kill her.
Aha, Breslin says, nodding slowly. Now I see what you're getting at, Detective. You're right. It is important. Everything else we've got looks like murder. And a pretty nasty one too. But if you're right about why that cooker got turned off, then it's not murder at all. It's manslaughter.
Exactly, I say. If I'm right.
If.
There's any number of reasons that cooker could have been turned off. Maybe Aisling turned it off herself. Or maybe Rory's got a touch of OCD going on. can't leave a house without turning all the appliances off. But if you're right...
We both look at Rory. He's glazing over. Too many stories log jamming in his head. He's starting to lose hold of them all. Up to a point, this works for us. If the guy can't keep track of what he said about what, when, he gets sloppy. Too far past that point, though. He just stops making sense. If we're going to get anything out of Rory, it needs to be soon.
I'm done, Rory, I say. You can talk now.
Breslin lets him open his mouth before he says, Actually don't. You're about to tell us you were never in that house. And you need to think very, very hard before you do that. Murder is an automatic life sentence, Rory. Manslaughter is maybe 6 years out in four. And if you don't tell us why you turned off that cooker, then we've got nothing. Not one thing that says this was manslaughter. And a whole lot that says it was murder. So I'm telling you, Rory, for your own sake, before you say one more word, take just 5 minutes to think. And when Rory tries talking again, 5 minutes. I'll tell you when it's up. He shoots his cuff and looks at his watch. Starting now. Rory gives up. He stares into space, rocking a little with fatigue. 1. Slowly the lines of Rory's face solidify. He stops swaying. Inside his mind, things are moving. Breslin's made the wrong call. I know what he's at. He's hoping the forced silence and the fear will bear down on Rory hard enough to crack him. But it's the barrage of words and demands that was doing the job. Locking this guy into his own head is only giving him a chance to get his focus back and straighten out his stories. We're losing him. 2.
Forget it, I say, bringing my hands down on the table with a bang. That's as much time as he's getting. Rory, look at me.
I snap my fingers in his face. He blinks.
Why'd you turn that cooker off?
Too late.
Rory says, I didn't. I've never been inside Aisling's house. I never hurt Aisling in any way. And I want to go home.
He stands up, wobbly-legged, and starts trying to pull his coat off the back of his chair. His hands are shaking. He keeps losing hold.
Well there, Breslin says. We're not done. Sit down.
I'm done. Am I under arrest?
I can see Breslin opening his mouth on the words.
No,
I say, and ignore his head coming round towards me.
Not at the moment. But if you want us to believe your story, walking out on us isn't the way to go about it. You need to stay here and work with us. No. If I'm not under arrest, I'm going home.
Rory manages to get his coat off the chair and drops it.
Here's what we'll do, I say, closing my notebook. You go home, get some sleep. We'll talk to Aisling's neighbours and see if any of them happen to look out their back windows and see it in the laneway between, say, 8:30 and 8:40. If they did, you're off the hook. You wouldn't have had time for the other thing. Obviously, we've already talked to the neighbours, and I'm betting they would have mentioned some weirdo hanging around the laneway, but this doesn't seem to occur to Rory. Come back in to us tomorrow to sign your statement, and we'll do updates then. Fair enough. Rory pulls his coat around his shoulders, not even trying the sleeves.
Yes.
Okay. We'll come pick you up, Breslin says, keeping it just the right side of a threat.
He stands up and stretches.
You're not planning to be anywhere other than your flat or the bookshop, are you?
No, I'm going nowhere.
Good plan, Breslin tells him. He pulls the door open and sweeps his hand at it with a little mock bow. After you.
Steve is in the doorway of the observation room, suit jacket over his arm, sleeves rolled up against the heat. His eyes meet mine for a long level second. Then we're past him and down the corridor. Rory speeding up towards the draft of cold, fresh air coming up the stairwell. Breslin humming happily to himself under his breath.
Me and Braslin watch from the doorway as Rory heads off across the cobblestones. He looks small, messy, slams of wind flapping his coat and tangling in his hair, swerving him off course. It's practically dark. Just a couple of months of bodyguard work, and I'll have enough saved for a holiday somewhere blazing hot in eye-shattering colours and very far away.
Enlighten me, Breslin says pleasantly. Why is this guy going home?
I say, we're nearly there with him. He was right in the edge till that pause gave him a chance to pull his head together. And if we could get in there once, we can get in there again. But if we put him under arrest, he's going to get a solicitor in there and we can say goodbye to any chance of a confession.
We don't need a confession, Conway. We've got enough circumstantial stuff to bury him alive.
Which is probably true. I don't care. My last murder case. This one isn't going to be tacked down with circumstantial this and reasonable inference that. I'm going to hammer a stake right through its heart and leave it dead as dirt.
I want one, I say. We can afford to leave Rory till tomorrow.
Unless he jumps in the Liffey.
He won't. He still thinks I might wind up believing him. He wants that. Breslin watches me.
Is he right?
No, I say. The adrenaline buzz is ebbing fast. I can feel the post-interrogation crash getting ready to hit. It leaves a sucking empty spot that, if you're not careful, can feel like loss. I need caffeine, sugar, a dirty great burger.
He's our man, all right.
He is. And I hope you know that cooker doesn't actually turn it into manslaughter either.
There's no chance that little pussy boy was thinking straight enough, after killing someone, to worry about burning the house down. His brain was juice. He probably turned the cooker off because the food was starting to burn and the smell bothered him. Cooper's report still stands. Could be manslaughter if Rory managed to get up the strength for a serious punch. Or he could have deliberately smashed her skull in when she was down. And the more I look at those pathetic excuses for muscles, not my problem, I say. The lawyers and the jury can figure that one out. All I want is a watertight case that he killed her.
Well, Breslin says, heartily enough that for a second there I think he's going to clap me on the back.
That shouldn't be a problem to us. We'll get every warm body out there looking for backup evidence. We'll throw the lot at Rory and he'll fold like a cheap lawn chair. And if he doesn't, hey, we'll have enough circumstantial stuff to make our case watertight anyway. Right?
Right. I say. Rory is gone around the corner towards the gate. The splatter of yellow light on the empty cobblestones makes them look slick from hard rain. Dangerous. Wheels turning in Breslin's mind, so heavy I can practically hear them. I keep my eyes on the place where Rory was until, finally, I feel Breslin move away and hear the door close behind him. I ring Lucy from the women's jacks. This time she answers, but her voice is barely above a whisper and she sounds hassled. Someone in the background is calling orders and there's a sudden blast of country music, cut off by an annoyed shout. The theatre has a new show opening that evening. They're having technical problems and Lucy really has to go. In the background, Luce, any word on those Perkins? She swears she'll be home all tomorrow. But I can't tell whether it's true or whether she's just saying whatever will get rid of me. I'm going to be banging on her door tomorrow morning before she's anywhere near hauling her hangover out of bed. I hope she tells me she's made up Aisling's secret boyfriend to make sure the investigation was good and thorough. I hope that, as I step out of Lucy's flat, Sophie rings me to tell me that Aisling's password-protected computer folder turned out to be full of pictures of Daddy, scanned to make them handier for sobbing over. Me, praying my most interesting leads will crash and burn. It feels against nature, like some parasite has slid into my head and is eating bits of my brain. But Lucy and that folder,
They're the last two stubborn, unruly strands stopping me from tying everything into a neat bow, leaving it outside the door of O'Kelly's office with my badge on top and walking away. Steve is at our desk checking emails. I sit down next to him and start flicking through the piles of paper that materialised while I was away. The floaters try not to let me catch them glancing over, wondering when the mad bitch is gonna lose it again. The thick sheet of silence between me and Steve is growing edges like ripped tin. I say, "So you saw Rory in there?"
"A fair bit of it," Steve says, without looking up. "Good interview."
Doesn't sound like a compliment.
"Thanks," I say.
I catch Breslin's knowing eye on us. "You are never right for each other."
"Where were you?"
"I ran the mug books past the barman and Aisling's neighbours. No hits." He waits for me to say,
"I told you so."
When I don't. "Then I went and had chats with a few of the lads who worked the Des Murray disappearance. Don't worry."
"I was subtle about it."
"I'm not worried." Steve throws me a quick sideways glance, trying to work out how I mean that.
"Anyway," he says, after a second.
The tone to his voice, neutral, precise, arm's length. I've heard it before, but to defence solicitors, slippery journalists, never to me.
"According to them, McCann had a bit of a thing for Evelyn Murray, all right. He was the one who pushed to keep the investigation going. He got very eloquent about this poor, fragile woman with her life in ruins. And McCann isn't the eloquent type, so the lads remembered it. He even found her someone to buy Des's taxi play and made sure she got top dollar for it, so she and Aisling were struck for cash. But the lads are all positive and never went as far as an affair. Even back then, McCann was getting called Holy Joe. Not a chance he was riding a subject's missus. They laughed at me for even thinking it." Another gap for my "I told you so." I can't take any longer sitting there next to him, being polite to each other under Breslin's amused eye. I say, "Did you find a reason to think any of this has anything to do with our case?"
"No."
"Good.
Then let's get this meeting done." I stand up. Even before I reach the front of the desk, the floaters have dropped their work and are sitting up straight, managing to be all attention without, God forbid, making eye contact with a rabid animal.
"Okay," I say. "Good news. It's looking pretty definite that Rory Fallon is our boy. He and the CCTV both say he's been stalking Aisling for at least a month. That's how he spent the missing time before their date on Saturday night, or part of it anyway, peeping in her windows."
"Little perv," Staunton says, grinning. "Better swab our walls for DNA."
A quick edgy smatter of laughs.
"Do it," I say.
Rory's leftovers might not prove murder, but they'll up our chances at trial. Juries hate a wanker.
"He says he was hanging out in the laneway behind our patio. So get the text to give the wall a good going over. And try the wall under her kitchen window too, just in case he got up the guts for a little close range action."
Staunton nods. Mean puts it in the book of jobs. I say,
"Our new working theory is that when Rory arrived in Aisling's house, she somehow found out about the stalking. She told him to get out and he lost the head."
"Rory hasn't spilled the beans yet," Breslin says, "but he's come close. We're hoping tomorrow's the day."
"Before we pull him back in," I say, "let's find out just how much stalking he did and what kind. I need two guys walking Rory's picture around Stony Batter to see if anyone recognises him from the last couple of months. He's got the bookshop to run, so we're mainly looking at evenings and Sundays. Try everywhere. Houses, shops, pubs, offices where the workers might have crossed paths with him on their way out. Any community groups or bingo nights or sports clubs, track down the members."
Kelleher lifts a finger.
"Kelleher, you and Gaffney take that.
and I want to know what Rory's phone's been doing over the last 2 months. When it pinged towers around Stony Batter, whether it logged on to any wireless networks in the area. Staunton, while you're making calls, make those. The case has changed. Before, we were dragnetting, sifting through what came up and hoping there was something good in there. Now we're hunting. We've got the prey in our sights and we're closing in. And everything we do is building towards the moment when we'll have him pinned down for the kill shot. That feeling, it's not some bullshit figure of speech. It lives inside you, somewhere deeper and older and more real than anything else except sex. And when it comes rising, it takes your whole body for its own. It's a smell of blood raging at the back of your nose. It's your arm muscle throbbing to let go the bowstring. It's drums speeding in your ears and a victory roar building at the bottom of your gut. I let myself love that feeling one last time. I let myself drink it down, cram every second of it deep into me, lay away my store of it to last me the rest of my life. I want to know where Rory drinks, I say, and what the barman and the regulars think of him, if he's got a rep for fixating on some girl, not taking no for an answer, if he's got a temper, anything that could be relevant. Mean's hand is up. Mean, have that. It'll give you a change of scenery from Stony Batter. And I want to know what the other Ranelagh businesses think of Rory. Whether anyone's got any stories about him coming on a little strong to a customer in the bookshop. Or hanging about outside the bakery waiting for the pretty one to finish her shift. I'll do that, Breslin says. Morin, fancy joining me? Steve looks up, startled. But Breslin gives him a bland smile and after a second he says, yeah, sure. Great, Breslin says, throwing him a wink. Let's take this bad boy down. I don't feel like going into my plans for tomorrow. I'll check in with the Bureau first thing in the morning, I say. See if they've got anywhere with fibre matches and DNA. And with Aisling's computer folder, which I also don't feel like mentioning. Meanwhile, someone needs to stay on Rory's gaff just for tonight and part of tomorrow till we're ready to bring him back in. Breslin gives me an amused glance. I don't actually think Rory's going to throw himself in the Liffey or skip town or ditch evidence we haven't spotted. But I'm not going to risk it for the sake of a few hours' surveillance. DC, do that or stick a couple of uniforms on it if you want. But tell them they need plain clothes and an unmarked car. DC nods. Okay, I say, if we don't get a confession, this is the stuff that's going to make the case. So give it your best. Thanks, and see you tomorrow. In the second before I turn away to get Steve so we can pretend we're still partners while we report to the gaffer, the incident room grabs me by the gut. For that second it glows warm and steady from every corner with 20 years worth of might-have-beens. Every time I could have walked in there laughing with Steve, every shout of triumph when I could have held up the phone record or the DNA result we'd been waiting for, every thank you speech I could have made at the end of a big case, all of those rise up to find me, now that they're unreachable. I don't do that shite. I've got half a dozen excuses handy. No sleep, no food, pressure, big decision, blah, blah, blah. But still, that against nature feeling prickles my skin like nettle rash. Let's go, I say to Steve. The gaffer. I head out the door without waiting for him, so we won't have to walk down the corridor together. O'Kelly is polishing the dust off his spider plant with one of those fiddly little cloths that people use to clean their glasses.
Conway, Morin, he says, barely glancing up. Tell me you're getting somewhere.
Yeah, I say. Looks like we are.
About fucking time, let's hear it.
I give him the rundown. He listens, turning the plant to the light to make sure he gets every angle.
Huh?
He says when I'm done.
And you're happy enough with that.
One sideways eye has come up to me. I say, we'll have another shot at the confession tomorrow.
Don't worry. We won't send the file to the prosecutors till we've got it locked down tight.
I didn't mean are you happy enough to send the file. I mean are you happy enough that Fallon did it?
Yeah, I say. That eye edged wet and red where the eyelids starting to droop like an old man's. I can't read him. I can't make myself care whether or not he's in on Breslin's game. He did it. I feel Steve's weight shift beside me, but he says nothing. The gaffer eyes me for another long moment before he turns back to his plant. He tilts a leaf to examine it, gives one spot an extra dab.
I thought you were waiting for something that wasn't circumstantial.
Last night I told him that, back when this case was a wild thing, shooting out curls of possibility in every direction. Feels like years ago. That, or till we eliminated everything else. We've done that.
You have,
I say. There's zero reason to think that anyone other than Murray Fallon was involved. O'Kelly tests the point of a leaf on the pad of his thumb.
All right,
he says.
All right.
He looks like he's forgotten us. I can't tell whether we've been dismissed. We could use another floater, I say. I sent Riley back to the floater pool. That gets the gaffer's attention.
Why?
He found evidence. Instead of bringing it to me or to Moran, he took it to Breslin.
Can't have that,
O'Kelly says. He doesn't try to hide the long glance at Steve.
Okay, I'll get you another one. Keep me updated.
He turns his shoulder to us and works his fingers delicately into the plant, pushing the leaves apart to slide the cloth right down to the base. Steve says, in the corridor, zero reason to think anyone but Rory was involved. His voice still has that remote sound. Yeah, I say, exactly zero reason.
What about Lucy's mystery guy?
The folder on Ashlyn's computer. I'm seeing Lucy tomorrow. I'll ring Sophie about the folder first thing. If either of them gives us anything solid, then we'll review. I can hear the danger signs rising in my voice, but right now, zero reason, zero. The DNA on Ashlyn's mattress. That didn't get there on Saturday night, or it would have been on the sheets as well. It's got nothing to do with our case. Steve has stopped moving. He's looking off down the corridor at the window, dark sky, layered in a thick yellowish vapour of light pollution, not at me. I say, you saw Rory in there. You heard him. Don't you fucking tell me you still have doubts. It takes him too long to answer. I leave him there. I'm pulling my coat on when it hits me. Breslin made it through the entire afternoon without once trying to hint that he's on the take. Now that should be a relief, but instead it jabs like a needle under a fingernail. As far as I can see, there's no reason why Breslin should have suddenly, in the couple of hours I was away talking to Ashlyn's exes, decided to ditch his whole ornate, cunning plan. He was doing a lovely job of setting me up. Few more nudges and, if I hadn't been for fleas, I would have been right in position for the kill shot, and out of nowhere, he dropped the whole project and wandered away. I flick back mentally through the day, my chat with McCann, the floater's reports, checking for anything that could have made him change course, anything that might have tipped him off that I'd sussed him, or anything that could have made him decide I wasn't worth owning after all. There's nothing. The only possibility left is the one jabbing deeper. Breslin knows somehow that there's no point to that shite anymore. The words I'm going to say to the gaffer stink like burning hair all around me, brand my face with their growing shadow. Breslin took one look at me and knew, with those dense, packed 20 years worth of detective instincts, that the kill shot had already been fired. He knew I'm worthless now.
Chapter 13. All the way home, I'm waiting for something, or someone, another uniform pulling me over,
the lamppost guy leaping out in front of my car as I turn onto my road. Fleas sticking his head out of the darkness in my kitchen. Nothing happens. My street is a blank. As soon as I step into the house, I know it's empty. I clear it anyway. I'm craving sleep. A lot of it. Ideally, with someone armed and trustworthy outside my bedroom door. But I'm not going to bed till I know I'm wrecked enough to crash out the second I hit the sheets. There's a whole list of stuff I'm not going to think about tonight. But it covers so much territory, and I'm so tired that my mind keeps getting mixed up and letting bits slip through. For half a second, before I pull myself up sharp, I wonder what Steve is doing. There's fuck all in my fridge, and me and Fleas killed off my emergency fish fingers. I ring my ma and tell her about Sophie's vase, which has blood splatter on it because two scumbags broke into an old woman's gaff and punched her in the stomach till she puked blood, to which my ma says, "Huh?" She doesn't bring up Aisling, and neither do I. While she smokes, I make coffee and a pile of toast, cut the green bit off an old chunk of cheese, and take the lot into the sitting room. No wind shoving at the window tonight. It's died down, leaving a thick, still cold. I look out into the dark and think, come on, motherfucker, come and get me. I leave the curtains wide open. I've got an email from Fleas. Hiya, Rach. Great to hear from you. No news here. All the gang are okay. No one doing anything special. Kind of busy at the mo, but love to meet up sometime when we both have the free time. Take care, sunshine. Kiss, kiss. Meaning no one in his corner of the underworld is suddenly drowning his sorrows or looking twitchy or sobbing on Flea's shoulder about his dead girlfriend. I'm meaning bye. See you someday. Maybe. Sophie's team didn't find any dating sites on Aisling's laptop, but they haven't reported back on her work computer yet. I take a look at random Google Blonde's accounts. She's doing well for herself. Dozens of messages. About a quarter of them are dick pics, which are presumably meant to send her running for her smelling salts rather than to start off meaningful relationships. Although, you never know. Most of the rest are one-line nothing. Guys shotgunning all the pretty girls who join up, hoping one will bite. Two of them are worth a closer look. No photos. Careful wording about no strings and discretion. Married guys looking for fun on the side and looking for a girl who matches Aisling's specs to join them. I'm working on my reply when something moves in the corner of my eye. I whip around, not fast enough. A big dark shape skims away from my window before I can get a decent look. I grab my keys and dive for the door. By the time I get it open, the road is empty. I head for my car, forcing myself to keep the pace casual. Just getting something I forgot, no biggie. My breath puffs clouds into the air, but the cold doesn't touch me. I smell turf smoke and hear cars zipping past the top of the road and feel my leg muscles throbbing to go. I'm pulling open the car door when the light twitches. There's someone under the street lamp at the top of the road, a tall guy, hovering. I slam the car door and take one step in that direction and he vanishes, into the dark around the corner, going at a fair old clip. I'm pretty sure I'm faster than him, but Stony Batter is good for twists and laneways, and if he knows his way around, he's gone. Even if he doesn't, he can just nip into a pub, turn and stare with the rest if I come bursting in. What am I going to do about it? I need to nab him on my own turf. I go back inside, pull the sitting room curtains almost closed, and watch the road through the crack at one side. If I get another shot, it'll be my last. One more close call and the guy's gonna know for sure he's been burnt. There isn't a way for me to do this on my own. I run through every backup option I can think of. Fleas, Sophie, Gary, my mate Lisa, all my other mates, the neighbours. I even consider my ma. I swear to God, for a quarter of a second, I consider Breslin. I can't do it. There's no one on all that list who I can make myself ring up to say, hi, I can't do this. Come, help me. To every single one of them, I'd be a different person after that call. The emptiness of my gaff, feels dense enough to tilt it on its foundations. The guy's got some self-control at least. It's 25 minutes before a thicker darkness moves in the shadows outside the street lamp circle. In the same second, I feel my heartbeat rise to it. I realise that I've known all along what I'm going to do. The thicker darkness settles and stays. I get out my phone, I take a breath, and I ring Steve. It takes him a few rings to pick up.
"Hey,"
he says. "Hi, are you doing anything important?"
"Not a lot."
He leaves it there, that carefully neutral voice, while he tries to work out or decide whether we're still partners. I don't have time for fancy dancing.
"Steve,"
I say, "listen, I need a hand." It feels rough in my throat, but when I glance out the window, the guy is still there, motionless, at the edge of the lamplight. There's a long second of silence. I shut my eyes. Then Steve says,
"Okay, what's up?"
His voice has thawed two notches, maybe three. It's fucking ridiculous how relieved I am, but I don't have time to deal with that either. "Some fucker's been casing my gaff for the last few days," I say. "And I've had enough. I can't go out there and get him myself. He's got a clear line of sight on every route I can take. And if he sees me coming, he'll do a lagger." Steve says, and he's put everything else aside to focus on this.
"But he's not watching for me."
"That's what I'm hoping." "Where is he now?"
"At the top of my road."
Steve knows my gaff. He's never been inside, but we've swung by to pick something up once or twice. He was looking in my front window earlier on, and I've seen him down the laneway out the back. But he mostly hangs out at the corner. Tall guy, solid build, middle-aged, dark overcoat, trilby-type hat. I feel Steve clock the match to the guy who went over Aisling's wall.
"Okay," he says. "What you want me to do with him?"
"Bring him in here. I want a word with him."
"I'll be there in 15 minutes tops."
I can hear him moving already, pulling on shoes or getting into a coat. "Ring me when you're almost at my road. Let it ring once, then hang up."
"Right."
Keys jingling. Steve's ready.
"Mind yourself."
"Thanks," I say. "See you soon." I put my phone in my pocket, sit back down on the sofa and click shite at random on my laptop. The window feels like fingernails drumming at the side of my head. I don't look around. When my phone rings once, what feels like an hour later, I manage not to jump. I stretch, stand up and wander over to the front door, out of sight of the window. I get out my gun and press my eye up against the peephole. Darkness and the yellow door across the road, bulging insanely in the fisheye lens. The yappy little dog next door throwing a fit. Girls shrieking somewhere far away. Then a fast jumble of footsteps coming closer over the cobblestones. I hold the doorknob and make myself wait till a wild flap of black rears up in the peephole. Then I whip the door open. Two guys pressed close together stumble inside. And I slam the door behind them. They trip on the rug, get their balance back and stagger to a standstill in the middle of my sitting room. Steve is gripping the other guy's coat collar with one hand and twisting his arm up behind his back with the other. Big guy, black hair going grey. His hat's gone missing somewhere along the way. Long black overcoat.
"Get off me."
"I've got him," I say, and point my gun at the guy's head. Steve lets go and jumps back.
"For God's sake,"
the man says. Then he turns to face me and all three of us go still. He wasn't expecting the gun. I wasn't expecting him. I was all ready for anything from a serial killer to one of our own. But not for this guy. I've never seen him before, but I've seen everything about him. Every day. The strong curve of his nose, the hooded dark eyes, the long black slashes of his eyebrows. For a second it feels like some fucked up practical joke. My mind skidding, grabbing for handholds, wondering if the squad ranker somehow organised this to wreck my head. He's the spit of me. Steve is staring back and forth between us. His hands are open by his sides, like he's not sure what to do with them. I say, "Steve, you can go." My lips are numb. The man says, "Antoinette, shut the fuck up or I'll shoot you." I tighten my hands on the gun. He shuts up. "Steve, go home." Steve starts to ask, "Are you? Go. Now." After a moment he leaves, practically tiptoeing. The door closes softly behind him. Me and the guy are left looking at each other. He adjusts his coat collar where Steve had a hold of it. "Thank you," he says. I'm not sure who that was. "I asked him to bring you in," I say. "I've had enough of you hanging around my road." He's not fazed. "In that case, perhaps you both did me a favour." "I'm not sure when I would have got up the momentum to knock on your door." His accent is educated English, with something else overlaid on top. Nordy, maybe Belfast. He hasn't spent the last 32 years in a palace in Egypt or a nightclub in Brazil. He spent them a train ride away. "Have a good look around," I say. "You want the full tour?" He's examining my face intensely enough that I twitch, wanting to smash in his nose with the gun butt to make him stop. He says, "You're very like me. Do you understand that?" "I'm not blind," I say, "and I'm not stupid." That gets a tiny satisfied smile. Like me, not being an idiot is to his credit. "I never thought you would be." All that maths homework I saved up to drop at his feet. There's a silence while he waits for me to say something or maybe throw myself into his arms. I don't.
"This is a very strange moment for me," he says. "I've been looking for you for almost a year."
"Wow, a whole year, yeah?"
"I did consider making contact at the beginning, I give you my word, I did. But I didn't know your name and your mother had gone off the radar really very effectively. And at the time, given the various complications in my life, in many ways I felt you would be better off without."
"And now what? You need a kidney?" A thin smile. "The year before last, my mother and father died, within months of each other. A smaller pause for me to say sorry for his loss or feel bereaved or fuck knows what. Losing one's parents causes an immense shift in perspective. It brought home to me the value of their presence within my life on a much broader scale than I had ever understood it before. The value of being rooted within a greater story than one's own. I became acutely aware for the first time just what I had deprived you of. As soon as I reached that realization, I began looking for you." Those dark eyes all intense and urgent and meaningful. No wonder my ma fell for it. She was only 20. I'm not. The truth is he was feeling vulnerable all of a sudden, what with being next in line, and he needed someone who could make him feel like he wasn't going to vanish into nothing. "At one point I actually hired a private detective," he says, "but all I could give him was your mother's name and..." "You found me now." "As soon as I knew how to find you, I came. I booked a hotel in Dublin and drove down that very day." The face in him says he expects me to be all moved. "Shame you didn't find out a few weeks earlier," I say. "You could have got your Christmas shopping in."
"Is that really necessary?"
He nods at my gun.
"You must know I have no intention of hurting you."
"I and it does put a damper on the conversation. There's a smile at one corner of his mouth, a smile that he expects to work. A charmer, this guy. Shame that Jean skipped a generation. There's no conversation, I say. If Steve had the sense to do what I told him, he's in his car and well gone by now. Too far for this guy to chase him down and try to pump him for info. You're leaving. That takes the smile away. He says carefully, I realise you must be angry with me. I'm not angry. I'm done with you. Go on. I motion at the door with the gun. No, he says. His hands come up towards me. Let me stay, please. Just for a little while, an hour, half an hour. If you still want me to leave after that, I will. I say, out, now. Wait. He hasn't moved, but his voice sounds like a leap to bar the door. Please, I'm not going to pry. You can tell me as much as you like or nothing. It's up to you, and I'll tell you anything you want to know. You must have questions, anything, just ask me. Here it is, my deepest and darkest. The one that no best mate or partner or lover will ever know. In that second, I see what Aisling saw. I see the moment she's chased over barriers and through muck and out the other side of death. It bursts into my house like ball lightning and it sings in front of me and arms reach away. What's your name? How did you and my mom meet? Why did you go? Where have you been? What do you do? Tell me all of it. All. I see me tilting like a hawk high in warm air, while below me he unrolls all my might-have-beens for me to circle above at my leisure till every fork and tributary is stamped into my mind, reclaimed and mine. I see him opening his cloak to show me all the lost pages of my story written in silver on the night sky lining. Okay, I say. I lower the gun. Yeah, I've got questions. I can hardly breathe. And I can say, half an hour. Sure. Why not? He nods. He waits, gazing at me too intently to blink, hanging for the questions like they're the best gift I could ever give him. They would be. This is what my ma was telling me through all our bullshit fairy tales. If I let him give me the answers, he'll own me. Everything in my life, past and future, will be his. What he decides to make it into. I say, how'd you track me down? He blinks then. You said anything I want to know. He glances at the sofa. May I sit down? No. First you start answering, then I'll see. A wry quirk of one eyebrow, like he's decided to humour an overwrought kid. I use that look on witnesses sometimes. All right. I went to my local shop on Sunday afternoon to buy my newspaper. While I was in the queue, I glanced at the other papers on the stand. Your photograph was on a front page. I knew as soon as I saw you. It sends red straight through me. He's got no right recognising me. So, I say, what did you do? I looked you up in the phone book. But you're enlisted. I was certain your work wouldn't give me any information, so I rang the paper and asked to speak to the journalist who had written the article. I told him who I was. I could hardly expect him to give me any information otherwise, and that I was hoping to get in touch, but uncertain of my welcome. A dry glance at the gun. With good reason, apparently. And he just handed over my address. Even for Crowley, that doesn't ring true. Crowley does nothing for nothing. What'd you give him? I haven't given him anything. I know that crisp snap of denial too well to fall for it. Yes. I say. What did you promise him? He thinks about lying, but he's too smart to risk it. The journalist said he could provide me with an address for you,
in exchange for an interview after our meeting. I can just picture it. Top cop's childhood anguish. Side by side, photos of my shitty block of flats and his detached house in a leafy suburb. All the time, she was searching for the truth on the job. She was really searching for me, Sob's long-lost dad. Not the front page or anything. Part of some glurge spread about fatherless women. Just thinking about it makes me want to puke. Crowley wouldn't even need to publish it. He could just wave it under my nose and demand every scoop I ever have. And know I would hand them over. I say, "And you said, yeah, sure, no problem." I wasn't overjoyed about the prospect. Bearing my soul for some tabloid isn't something I ever envisioned myself doing. But I would have done much more than that to find you. He doesn't come across like an idiot, although you can never tell, I say. Or you could have just rung up my work and asked for me, or sent me a letter. I could have, yes. He runs a palm down one cheek and sighs.
I'll be honest. I wanted the chance to observe you for a while before making that commitment.
Meaning he wanted the chance to decide whether I was good enough to contact. If I'd had a fella in a shiny tracksuit, half a dozen screaming brats, and a smoke hanging off my lip, he could have turned around and gone home. No harm, no fell. Story ended before it began. Maybe he even believes that's why he did it this way. But I don't. I know exactly what he was at. Playing this the approved way. Break the news nice and gently from a distance. Have a few careful getting-to-know-you phone calls. Meet on neutral territory when everyone's comfortable with it. All that shite. That would have let me decide when and whether. This guy was never going to do that. He wanted this situation. Wanted me, on his terms, start to finish. Unlucky for him, that gene didn't skip a generation. I say. So, you spent the next 3 days hanging around and saw my gaff like a peeper? That flares his nostrils. I don't enjoy admitting it, but I said I would tell you anything you asked. I hope now you realise I meant it. Your journalist buddy gets nothing. First thing tomorrow, you ring him and tell him you had the wrong woman. And make it convincing. His head lifts. Pride looks good in him, and he knows it. I gave him my word. He wants me to beg, or stamp my foot, and remind him he owes me more than he owes some hack. I laugh. One crack. I'm not going to give him more. What's he going to do, sue? Obviously not, but I prefer to fulfil my obligations. When the corner of my mouth lifts. And I don't think either of us particularly want him as an enemy. Trust me. You'd rather have him for an enemy than me. You think I don't have friends on the force around your way? You want to spend the rest of your life being pulled over and breathalyzed every time you get in your car? Brought in for questioning every time a kid says the bad man had brown skin? His mouth wide, hard-cut curves, like mine, has tightened. He says, "This obviously means a lot to you." He leaves space for me to take the bait. I don't. All right, I'll tell the journalist I was mistaken. He nods at the sofa. Now, may I sit down? The cheeky fuck is already moving towards my sofa. Great, I say. I lift the gun and point it at him again. You can go now. That startles him. But your questions, don't you want to know? Nope. Off you go. He doesn't move. We said half an hour. I'm finished early. Half an hour, that was the agreement. I laugh out loud. You should have got it in writing. Fuck off. Don't come back. His jaw sets. If you're trying to hurt me, I'm trying to get you out of my gaff. If I want to hurt you, I'll use this. I move my chin at the gun. Go on. For a second, I think I'm going to have to do it. He's not used to backing down. Funny that. Neither am I. I see the moment when he realises I'll do it. It widens his eyes and he eases back a step towards the door. But he's not done.
I understand that this has been a shock. Believe me, this wasn't the way I would have chosen to... Let me leave you my card. When you feel differently... His hands going to his breast pocket. No, I say, and train my gun on that hand till it stops moving. We're done. If I ever see you again, I'm going to shoot you dead. And then I'll explain how terrified I was of my stalker. My friend Steve will back me up, and I'll sell the story of our tragic misunderstanding to your journalist pal for big bucks. Slowly his hand moves away from his pocket. He says,
"You're not what I visualized."